From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Brazilians hit the streets in cities across the country after the announcement Thursday of the Senate's decision to begin impeachment proceedings against the twice-elected Workers' Party president, Dilma Rousseff. There were massive demonstrations in support of the embattled president and much smaller ones supporting her impeachment. CCTV's Lucretia Franco was in Rio de Janeiro and filed this report.
After the vote, many people in the capital, Brasilia, jumped and cheered. Some waved Brazilian flags and hugged each other. While fireworks lit the Senate building at dawn, not everyone here was in a mood to celebrate. There were plenty of people who were unhappy about the result. In several Brazilian cities, clashes broke out between pro-Rousseff supporters and people who wanted to see her go. Local newspapers displayed the news on the front pages, some anticipating the list of the future ministers to be appointed by Vice President Michel Temer, who takes over until the impeachment trial is over. Temer, however, is also under investigation for breaking the same budget laws Rousseff is accused of violating. Temer's party, the Brazilian Democratic Movement Party, is also tainted in the public's eye. Many of its politicians have already been charged in the ongoing bribery scandal involving the state oil energy giant Petrobras. In the capital, Brasilia, people had mixed reactions.
What I feel now is that my dreams have been stolen from me. My dream of a society with less inequality and more social justice.
I'm feeling sad, very sad. You know the feeling when you lose your mother or a good friend? That's what I'm feeling now. But we, the Brazilian women, will never give up.
I am feeling sadness, but also a lot of rage. Sadness because I live in a country where democracy is not respected, where a president that was elected with over 54 million votes and did not commit any crime can be brought down by oligarchs and aristocrats who want everything, all the money for them.
Local media reported Rousseff had already cleared her belongings out of the presidential palace. She made a speech calling the decision sabotage and said she committed errors, not crimes. Lucrecia Franco, CCTV, Rio de Janeiro.
Rousseff is not taking things lying down. After the vote was announced, she struck back against the right-wing opposition. RT's Nicholas Sanchez O'Donovan was in the capital city, Brasilia, and filed this report.
As soon as the impeachment was announced, Dilma Rousseff came out and in a very angry but very clear message, not only for her supporters but also for her political opponents.
I was elected president by 54 million Brazilian citizens. This is a decisive moment for Brazil's democracy and for our future as a nation. What's at stake in the impeachment process is not only my mandate. What's at stake is the respect for the polls, for the sovereign will of the Brazilian people and for the Constitution.
She said that she may be forced to step aside for the moment, but she's no way stepping down. She said that the whole political, the whole impeachment process is a farce, that there's no legal base for it. She said she has committed no crime. We have to remember that allegedly they're accusing her of misusing the budget laws down here in Brazil. And what about the presidency? Well, the current president now in Brazil is Michel Temer. He was the VP till early this morning. Temer is a member of the PMBD party. It's a centre-right wing party, very different ideologically to what Dilma's party is. So he's definitely going to take some different steps towards the economical recovery. That's his priority. He says he wants to put Brazilian economy back on track. So we'll have to wait and see how Temer does in office and how Dilma Rousseff starts the process of defending herself from this impeachment.
Meanwhile, whistleblower website WikiLeaks released a tweet that revealed the acting president, Michel Temer, is a U.S. embassy informant. The tweet provided links to two cables involving Temer's reports to the U.S. Embassy in Brazil about certain political matters. A cable from January 11, 2006, recites that Temer met with embassy officials on January 9th of that year to give an assessment of Brazil's political landscape ahead of the 2006 general election that saw then-Workers' Party President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva re-elected. In the cable, Temer criticized the president, saying, quote, his excessive focus on social safety net programs that don't permit growth or economic development, closed quote, were a problem. The cable also reveals that in 2006, Temer's party, the PMDB, was considering an alliance with both the leftist Workers' Party and the right-wing PSDB. The decision by that party to switch sides in the current crisis, despite the fact that Temer was elected vice president as a running mate of Rousseff, was a critical element in the effort by opposition elites to oust Rousseff. Another cable in June 21st of 2006 reports that Temer held a second meeting with U.S. Embassy staff to once again apprise them of the political situation in Brazil. In that cable, Temer complained about the lack of power given to his PMDB's ministers by the Lula government. Temer's belief that he was being left out of Rousseff's governance decisions was apparently a factor motivating his eventual support for her impeachment. The opening of a U.S. missile shield station in Romania produced new protests from Moscow about NATO encroachment and encirclement. NATO again dismissed Russian concerns as unjustified and irresponsible. The Western alliance claims that the system is purely defensive, aimed at what it terms rogue states, such as Iran and North Korea. However, Russia said the record clearly shows that since the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO has moved closer and closer to its borders and has moved aggressively in ways reminiscent of the Cold War. Press TV's Shekufi Ranjbar reports.
On Thursday, a land-based U.S. Aegis Ashore facility was inaugurated in Romania, which is to be followed by the groundbreaking of a similar missile test in Poland. Russia has been clear in its stance on NATO's military buildup near its borders. The Kremlin reiterated that a deployment of a missile system constitutes a threat to Russia's national security. It also condemned the installation of the missile system in Romania as a breach of a 1987 nuclear treaty between Moscow and Washington. But NATO insists that the $800 million missile project at Russia's doorstep is totally benign for Russia.
Missile defense is for defense. It is defensive. It does not undermine or weaken Russia's strategic nuclear deterrent.
The U.S. also claimed the move is vital to defend the United States and its NATO allies against Iran's ballistic missiles, missiles which Tehran has time and again assured to be purely defensive. But Moscow dismissed the assertions about the threat of missile attacks from Iran as unfounded. The head of Russia's Defense and Security Committee noted that the deployments in Romania and Poland are aimed at deterring his country's strategic nuclear forces. He raised concern that the deployment elements could be transformed in no time into systems carrying nuclear weapons. Viktor Azarov says Moscow will respond with military technical countermeasures, which could include the deployment of advanced Iskander-M missile systems in the Kaliningrad region.
We're looking square in the face of the very near-term prospect of a thermonuclear war, for which Obama has openly deployed the necessary forces, believing insanely that a preemptive strike against Russia and or China could take out the nuclear response capacity of those nations. This is insane, but it could in fact lead to a war.
The activation of the missile system in Romania came a day after non-NATO member Georgia began a two-week joint war game with the United States and Britain. Moscow angrily slammed the maneuvers as provocative. Russia has been beefing up its border security and is staging massive military drills in response to NATO's expansion into its backyard and the alliance's intensified activities near the Russian borders. The latest deployments and a possible response from Moscow could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international affairs at Moscow State University, via Skype Thursday.
We see this as part of a global overlapping, a ring of containment that is going up around Russia and China. The U.S. already has its own systems. There are some more primitive systems in Europe already. This is going up in Poland and Romania. The U.S., Secretary of Defense Carter is now insistent that this THAAD system will go into place in South Korea, which threatens China's strategic deterrent as well as Russia. And all of this is being undone under the pretext that it is against Iran in the European theater and against North Korea in the Eastern theater, in the Asia-Pacific. Now, of course, this is just a pretext. They say this for diplomatic reasons, for budgetary reasons, for feeding it to their own people. But, you know, and they try to make claims that this system doesn't threaten Russia's nuclear deterrent. And in isolation, right now, yes, they're right. But, you know, in the same way that the United States argues that it needs it for future developments, not that Iran has a nuclear weapon now. This is Russia's concern as well, that this system will be slowly built upon, expanded, piecemeal, pieces here, pieces there, improvements there, and this will continue unabated over time. They see it as precedent setting, and that this presents a marginal strategic threat at this point, but a much greater threat going on into the future as new developments and new parts, new systems come in place. It also establishes this powerful radar screen covering Western Russia. And of course, it sets the precedent of putting permanent U.S. military bases in Poland and Romania, which haven't been done before. And of course, there's always the possibility for expanding them. You have this, of course, on the back of all the NATO declarations now of piling up, U.S. piling up equipment and promising to send new troops to put on Russia's border. Germany announcing that they will put troops on Russia's border to deter Russia. You have to imagine the Russians aren't too happy about having German troops placed on their border, considering the historical context between the two of them.
The U.S. has also been very aggressive towards Russia over Syria, hasn't it?
This week, Russia, which it had announced to do previously, took a motion to the United Nations Security Council requesting that two extreme Salafist jihadist groups in Syria, this is Ahrar al-Sham, which is a splinter group of al-Qaeda off of al-Nusra. Its leader was trained in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda and has seen in multiple photographs with bin Laden himself. Recently, al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, they recently tried to have a merger to merge back in together, couldn't agree because al-Nusra was refusing a formal separation denouncement of Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader, even for form's sake. Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra are once again back in the Jaish al-Fatah. This is the Islamic Army of Conquest Operations Room. This was very successful in taking over Idlib province last year, which Idlib province is now essentially ruled by al-Nusra al-Qaeda. It was then temporarily put on a hold because of infighting, the typical, quote, rebels, unquote, fighting over rents, resources, supplies of weapons, foreign backers, etc. But it's once again back on, so they're once again fully cooperating together. So this is a group that goes far beyond the UN Security Council resolution definition of associating with al-Qaeda, which we have two UN Security Council resolutions calling for their destruction.
You know, the other there was group, something cute.
Jaish al-Fatah.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, is another Salafist extremist organization. This one is extremely openly backed by Saudi Arabia, whereas Ahad al-Sham is backed by mostly by Qatar. The Army of Islam is most famous. The chief negotiator of the Riyadh Assembled High Negotiations Committee at Geneva is from Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam. And they're perhaps most famous. I mean, they've done the whole nine yards, route of suicide bombing, head chopping. But they filmed themselves putting civilians, women, children, men, in literal cages on top of buildings as human shields to avert Syrian government airstrikes a year ago. That's the kind of people these are. So Russia took a resolution to the Security Council asking that both of these violent, head-chopping, suicide-bombing, Salafist jihadist groups be added to the black, the terrorist blacklist, along with ISIS and al-Nusra al-Qaeda in Syria. And standing shoulder to shoulder, Obama, Cameron, and Francis Holland bravely blocked this in defense of these jihadist groups.
You know what was really cute? Aside from the fact that this is happening while Cameron is hosting a global forum on corruption right after we find out that his inheritance was tax sheltered in the Panama. At the press conference, the daily press conference Wednesday at the Department of State, Elizabeth Trudeau was conducting that. And she was asked, I think, by Matt Lee, essentially, both of those groups have exactly the same bylaws as both al-Qaeda and Jabhat al-Nusra, and why shouldn't they be designated? They said they practice the same practices, they have the same, espouse the same dogma, believe the same things, have the same bylaws. Why shouldn't they be designated? And he said, well, because they're participating in the negotiations, we don't want to upset that, which... You know, then why aren't al-Qaeda and these others at the table as well? There was a reason for all of that, right?
Well, one of the reasons why the negotiations probably aren't going very well is because there's violent jihadists sitting at the table expecting, right, with the U.S. expecting to include. I mean, do we really want the political participation of these groups in the future Syria? The Syrians that I know certainly don't. Right. Maybe the U.S. and Saudi Arabia does want them as part of a future Syrian government.
What happened to the "we don't negotiate Russia with terrorists" thing?
I don't think Russia will go for that. Yeah. on top of this, we saw when the latest version of the cessation of hostilities was extended to Aleppo at the end of last week. Which is a kind of a joke in itself. Obama, for the second time, once again, tried, you know, via Kerry to Lavrov, tried to add, to exclude areas where Jabhat al-Nusra, that is al-Qaeda in Syria, was located in and around Aleppo, where they dominate, because some Western proxy FSA battalions were in close proximity, mingled, marbled, whatever you want to call it. You know, they're allies, buddies in the trenches, and the U.S. doesn't want its proxies hit. So right now, it's so cynical. These much larger jihadist forces, al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, they are using the West CIA proxies as human shields. I mean, they serve a multiple of purposes. They're the designated advanced U.S. weapon units. They're holding the TOWs and so on. They help funnel money into these groups. Again, there's the FSA commanders have been open that they openly tithe 50% of the weapons and money they get to al-Nusra. They serve as, you know, the PR, the whitewashing. And now they're literally serving as the human shields, too. And they are an extreme minority in comparison to the much larger jihadist groups, which is why the U.S. either can't or is unable to separate their proxies from these groups. Because if they were separated, you know, the non-jihadi amount of the rebellion would be revealed for the paltry amount it is, and it would quickly fold.
Yeah.
A big problem with what's going on is Russia has, to some extent, been paralyzed by its own diplomatic games with these ceasefires and cessation of hostilities. It has, by its own military's admission, been withholding strikes against Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and the other jihadist groups because of the West's objection to their proxies embedded with them being hit. And this has allowed them to reorganize, most particularly with the resuscitation of this Islamic Army of Conquest Joint Operations Room, to get thousands of reinforcements across the border from Turkey to rearm. And there's lots of incident. There's lots of incidents that tended to make me believe that at least some number of man pads, whether directly from the U.S. or through Saudi, via the U.S., have now arrived on the battlefield as well. And they have made offensives, you know, in several different locations. Most importantly, in East Homs and around Aleppo. And they have made gains, which is something we haven't seen really since the beginning of the Russian intervention in September. We were used to see the Syrian army, slow but steady, make gains and gains and win every situation. Now Russia has been calling off the close air support while these groups attacked, and then the Western plus claims that the, you know, and the U.S. government claims that the Syrian government broke the ceasefire. You know, they're being attacked in offensives in multiple locations. And then Russia can't hit them back because of the U.S. in proxies embedded with them. And this led most notably this week to the death of 13 Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps members. The next morning, Russia pounded this town that was taken by, again, Jabhat al-Nusra and a few other hangers-on. But, you know, this was vengeance. This was a day short and a dollar late. And Iran and Hezbollah, just this morning we have word that a Hezbollah commander in the Damascus area, outside the Damascus airport, was killed in an Israeli airstrike.
Really?
So either this Israeli airstrike was hovering over Golan or perhaps even entered Syrian airspace, fired off a missile, and Russia held off on S-300s, its air defense, and just allowed it to happen. Mm. So we see Syrian boys and women in the Syrian Arab Army and the defense militias. We see Hezbollah soldiers. We see Iranian soldiers dying.
Yeah.
When they didn't, they're dying needless deaths because Russia is embroiled in, I would think, naive diplomatic games. I sincerely hope that Russia does not believe that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Turkey will come to any kind of equitable terms of this. If they do, they're extremely naive. I can only hope they're playing for some type of long game and advantage, but for the life of me, I can't figure out what it is. And in the meantime, their alliance is fraying. The Kurds are starting to question their loyalties and have had some altercations with the Syrian army, and the U.S. is wooing them as well. And Iran, Hezbollah, the Syrian army, they're upset because right now they're being pressed. They're being pressed from ISIS around Palmyra. They're being pressed from al-Nusra around Aleppo. and East Toms. And they're having a tough fight again without the Russian close air support, particularly with all the, you know, the reinforcements and arms that they've gotten in recent days. It's obvious. Now, there are some reports that Russia is bringing tanks back into the country. So I guess Putin's mission accomplished moment failed. Mm. And Kerry made a really facetious comment this week, I believe, that he said, oh, he hopes that the Syrian and Russian forces are able to hang on to Palmyra because ISIS has made an attack on the supply lines that connect Homs with Palmyra, and this is in danger of being severed. And you know, of course, this is because the Syrian troops are spread really, really thin right now.
Yeah.
Because they're having to defend multiple areas. They thought they would be able to advance just against ISIS. Well, the ceasefire is being broken all over the place with a wink and a nod by al-Nusra with Western proxies embedded in them. And the Syrian army has to defend in multiple different directions now instead of just one. And, you know, they may not have the numbers in a war of attrition to do that. So Russia really needs to, you know, get on board and realize that they've bought into this thing. They made a statement, Lavrov made a statement just over a week ago, that Assad was not Russia's ally, not like Turkey is the U.S., you know, Erdogan is the U.S.'s ally. And I found that really difficult. I've never been a big fan of Assad myself, but he represents the Syrian state and the Syrian people right now. Right. And I just can't believe that the Russian government is making statements like that. They've bought into this. They better, you know, make up their minds.
Yeah,
whether they're going to hang or not.
Not for nothing. I mean, Erdogan is actually conducting war against the Turkish state, and it's the Turkish state that's the U.S.'s ally.
I don't know who Erdogan isn't conducting a war against at this point.
Yeah,
he's conducting a war against the EU and blackmailing them and having their comedians and journalists imprisoned if they criticize him. He's in a civil war in his own country against the Kurds. He's fighting in Syria. He's he has terrible relations with Armenia and with Greece, of course. He's at war with his own academics and journalists whom he's imprisoned.
Yeah, I'm waiting for him to invade Austria and Hungary. I mean,
he's absolutely trolling the EU. He knows he has the EU over a barrel on this whole migrant issue and the deal, you know, where he openly, you know, we've seen the transcripts, the leaked transcripts, where he threatened to flood the EU with more migrants unless they agreed to his terms. He accused the EU of being a haven for terrorists this week.
I know, I saw that. And, you know, you speak about how Russia is behaving, at least in a circumspect way. I'm wondering if, you know, from the Kremlin, looking out at what's going on with German troops involved in war games on their border and
in Georgia,
you know, everything that's happening, if they're not being cautious because, you know, they realize that the military assets are in place to strike at Russia in the event that Russia acts too aggressively in Syria or somewhere else in the view of
certainly.
The West.
I mean, the military stranglehold is starting to tighten down. You know, the sanctions themselves weren't too severe when coupled with the oil price war. That proved more severe when they were cut off from, Western finance centers. They've had to really adjust and make do. They really believe in the Kremlin, I think, that some people in the Kremlin believe that they can return to business as usual, and they just have to turn the corner on Syria with a quick victory that will win the West over to their side and reach an accommodation and a deal with elections in Donbass finally happening under Minsk in Ukraine, and that it'll be able to then round the corner and go back to business as usual, at least with Europe, if not the United States. And I just think that the people in the Kremlin that do believe that are incredibly naive. There is no return to normal anymore, and, you know, they had better get used to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.